Today I want to talk about a grown-up subject and a controversial one. And so I ask your tolerance in ahead of time. My scripture is Romans 14, 1 and 8. Welcome with open arms, fellow believers, who don't see things the way you do. And don't jump all over them every time they do or say something you don't agree with, even when it seems that they are strong on opinions, but weak in the faith department. Remember, they have their own history to deal with. Treat them gently. It's God we are answerable to, all the way from life to death and everything in between, not each other. Our country is experiencing right now a deep chasm, a palpable division of opinion that is causing an emotional upheaval much more serious than I've experienced before in my lifetime. One of the saddest facts, and perhaps the most unsettling about this phenomenon, is that sincere Christians can be found on both sides of the divide. Christians can disagree, of course. The human experience lends itself to an unlimited amount of uncertainty. But when Christians let differences of opinion boil up into ugly accusations, angry quarrels, and bitter splits, then we not only suffer individually, but our whole faith community is dragged through the dirt and mocked by the world. Where is that love they're always bragging about? I don't want to have anything to do with people who are such obvious hypocrites and frauds. Everyone claims to have God on his or her side, so how can we know which God to believe in? This is a serious, serious situation. Since this divide is more than an annoying political intrusion into our lives as Christ followers, I've decided to tackle today one of the most controversial subjects for bitter disagreement in our country, and that is the question of deliberate abortion. I'm pretty sure no one doubts me when I say that if abortion is not the top subject of contention among Christians in the United States, it is certainly in the top two. Feelings run strong and tense on both sides of the issue. All of us know from experience that this is not a safe topic for casual conversation among strangers. And it shouldn't be. Voluntary abortion, or termination as it is called in England, is a thing that demands the utmost seriousness no matter which side of the debate you're on. We all agree that it is a decision that shouldn't be made lightly or without educated counsel and reflection. But after that, we don't agree on much. You all know the rhetoric. Abortion is murder. Abortion stops a beating heart. Versus, a woman has a right to her own body. This is a decision that should be made by a woman and her doctor. If any dialogue occurs at all, it is emotion-packed and contentious. Before I go further, though, I want to make clear what my position on this delicate subject is and why. I do oppose voluntary abortion and find the practice abhorrent. But that said, I also can't find the issue a simple, black and white, this is the truth, case closed situation. One very good reason for this is that I don't have a clear thus saith the Lord to back me up. Abortion, per se, is never mentioned in either the Old or New Testaments, and this is not because it wasn't heard of back then. Abortions have been attempted for as long as there have been women desperate enough to risk their lives to rid themselves of an unwanted pregnancy. And they often didn't live through the painful, crude procedures of the time. The risk of infection or poisoning or bleeding to death was extremely high. Yet in spite of the fact that abortion isn't mentioned in Scripture, people do produce verses to back up their position against abortion. One favorite is Jeremiah 1:5. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nation. The difficulty is that in context, these words from God were spoken to a reluctant Jeremiah to underscore, with Hebrew hyperbole, that he had been especially chosen by God from the beginning to be a prophet, God's special spokesman. We are on shaky ground if we try to infer from this passage that all babies are chosen by God while still in the womb. Words spoken to a specific person, addressing a specific situation, can't be assumed to apply to everyone. The passage is often quoted from Psalms and Job also, taken in their context, have nothing to do with abortion, but rather emphasize that God is the author of all creation. Nevertheless, I still believe that a biblical case can be mounted against the moral acceptability of abortion. We are told from Genesis onward that life is sacred because all of us have a spark of God within us. If human life contains a spark of the divine, then from its first inception, the moment when the sperm and the egg make a bingo, that spark is present. Consequently, to purposefully extinguish that spark is to kill a godlike being. How can this not be wrong? Yet many, many people, including large numbers of Christians, do not agree with me about this. Polls show that a majority of Americans want abortion to be legal. So evidently they have no problem with or have made peace with the moral questions surrounding abortion. How have they reached this conclusion? What do they believe? Of course, many people, either actively or through default, don't believe in God. So arguments about sparks of the divine or fetuses having his approval carry no weight with them. Some of them may have qualms about abortion because they sense that life itself has some special quality, but God does not factor in their decision. Christians who are pro-abortion would probably agree that we have God in us, but argue about when that life first appears. When do we acquire our souls? Is it at conception, or when the fetus starts to move, or when the baby is capable of life outside the womb, or at birth? You see the problem. The early church originally believed that the baby's quickening, or first perceived movement, was the sign that the soul had entered the body. As you know, the Roman Catholic Church has changed that opinion to believe that the soul is present from conception on. I have to admit that I have no proof for agreeing with them, no real theological proof, no scientific proof, no concrete logical proof. It just seems reasonable to me that human life is human life, and would as such have God present from the beginning. That tiny little zygote is going to grow and emerge into the world, fully human and a child of God. Only death can change that, and death is sin. So that's what I believe, and I believe it firmly. I believe that it squares up with what I read in scriptures, that it is not an irrational or an emotional-driven conclusion that I have drawn from the facts at hand. But I can't prove it, and I can respect others who have honestly come to a different conclusion. What I can't respect is the emotional, fractious atmosphere that attempted discussions about this subject elicit. I've certainly had my share of conversations with relatives and friends about the morality of abortion. These are intelligent, educated people. My mother and I used to go round and round about this issue, for example. They not only disagreed with me, but I sometimes got the feeling that we were speaking different languages, and I could not get through to them why I thought it was wrong to end an unborn life, and why I thought the life of the fetus, so completely dependent on the mother, was not a part of the mother. I'd say, this baby isn't like a heart or kidney. When the time is right, it's coming out. It has a separate heart and a brain and lungs, for heaven's sake. I was equally impervious to their arguments that this little bit of growing flesh was not a child yet, and that it was foolish emotionalism to think of it as a real baby. At some point, I realized that we aren't even listening to each other. We are so sure of the righteousness of our own position that we completely tune out the opposition. And that is true of both camps, right to life and right to choice, as they're known. Each side is so deeply entrenched and so completely clothed in what they consider the armor of truth that they don't listen to a word the other side says. In this all-too-familiar format, it's a no-win situation. However, it's also an unacceptable situation. Women and children are suffering. Fetuses are dying. Our country is split down the middle. And we Christians are too often fighting like street ruffians. We need to get a grip and do better, much better, and quickly. So this morning I want us to look at some of the facts about voluntary abortion, and then to think about the problem as objectively as we can. We need to scout out some common ground to start building bridges across that chasm I mentioned earlier. We will get nowhere plugging up our ears, stomping our feet, and butting our heads together. God expects more of us than loud drum thumping. Too much is at stake. I think we all know what voluntary abortion is, as opposed to involuntary abortion, commonly known as miscarriage. Voluntary abortion is the termination of a pregnancy brought about by a procedure that causes the fetus to evacuate the woman's body before time for birth and results in the death of the fetus. 40 to 50 million abortions are performed worldwide each year. Over 59 million abortions have happened in the United States since the Roe v. Wade U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1973. This averages to over a million abortions a year. But the good news is that the number per year in the United States has actually been dropping in the past few years. The Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision made it illegal for states, as many had done, to make abortion illegal in the first trimester. States could also only enact abortion regulations reasonably related to the maternal health in the second and third trimesters, and could enact abortion laws protecting the fetus only in the third trimester. Even then, the court required that an exception had to be made to protect the life of the mother. Only a handful of Supreme Court decisions have resulted in such a firestorm of protest and produced a controversy that has lasted for over a generation now and is still going strong today. It wasn't as if abortions were not being performed before 1973. There were always a few doctors who, under some circumstances, would perform them illegally. Plus, an active back-alley industry flourished outside the law. A woman who found herself facing an embarrassing or otherwise unwanted pregnancy, and who had enough money and enough courage, could find someone willing to do the job. Or she could go to Sweden or some other country where abortion wasn't illegal. Unfortunately, it was also true that if she was poor or too frightened to seek help, she might try it herself. Women's rights advocates are not wrong that safe, sterile clinics, staffed by trained experts, all subject to regulation and inspection, saves lives. But they take them too, and that is the problem. Who exactly are these women with unwanted pregnancies who seek abortion? We need to zero in on them because right-to-life people seem to project such a vague, nebulous image of the average woman who wants to end her pregnancy. We used to immediately think of a white, unmarried teenager, afraid or unwilling to face the disgrace of giving birth out of wedlock. Boy, have those times changed. Now, unless the girl is very, very young, no one bats an eye. People live together without benefit of clergy, and even fairly conservative churches accept it as the new norm. Not many years ago, when I was driving past St. Joe's, I noticed a white limousine with cans tied on the bumper and with a baby seat installed prominently waiting for the wedding that was taking place inside the church to end. I couldn't help but think how unimaginable that would have been back in the 50s when I was a girl. No one would have dared. It would have been flaunting your shame. We won't take time now to discuss whether this change in societal mores is good or bad, but note that this image of the typical woman seeking abortion is no longer accurate. Nor is it often a woman who finds pregnancy a hindrance to her career plans, or is it a couple who want a boy and discover the wife is carrying a girl or vice versa. This does happen sometimes, sadly, but it is not the norm, and it does a disservice to the reality of the problem not to have a clearer picture of the facts of the situation. The truth is that a typical abortion patient is a 20-something single mother of color. 75% of them are poor. In third world countries, the number is higher than that. Some of them are devastated to end their pregnancies, while others of them are flagrant abusers of the system. Some of them feel nothing for their lost babies, others mourn them deeply. But they all have in common that for some reason, they do not want to have this baby. It may be a decision made reluctantly, or it may be a so what, but it is real and it is true, and we can't ignore this fact when we consider the problem of abortion. It seems to me that a serious lack of concern by many of the opponents of abortion to the plight of the mother-to-be who doesn't want to be is one of the bigger wedges widening the gulf between the two sides of the abortion problem. Anger toward the mother for wanting to abort her baby too often appears to be the common attitude among right-to-lifers. A frightened woman who is trying to make possibly the most difficult decision of her life doesn't need to have people screaming, "baby killer," at her as she seeks help for her problem. In fact, what she undoubtedly needs is compassion and kindness. The reasons for a woman wanting to end her pregnancy are different for each woman, but the majority of them are not frivolous, selfish, or uncaring decisions. The single mother with a low-paying job may not see how she can feed another mouth or clothe another body. If she's on her own, she undoubtedly can't afford child care. Or what about the woman who's a drug addict, unable to care for herself, much less an infant going through drug withdrawal? Another woman might be mentally ill and confused about what's happening to her. There are women who are on medications that will damage the fetus. Or how about the 11-year-old girl who is pregnant? Or a woman who is a victim of rape or incest? We haven't even started in on the problems of women in third world countries, war-ravaged or suffering from famine. I'm not suggesting that their problems are so awful that of course these women should have abortions. What I am saying is, where is our compassion? What are we doing to help them? These women in so many cases are people who need help, who need options other than abortion to help them make their decisions. Better yet, these women need not to be pregnant in the first place. It's about now that a certain type of person, with their nose slightly elevated in the air, says, "Well, I don't feel the slightest bit sorry for them. They know how babies are made." Or if the woman is unmarried, she's just paying for her sin. This kind of talk makes me want to put on my pointy-toed shoes and start kicking. All sin bears fruit, I'm afraid. And if it bore physical fruit for all of us, how many of us would be sitting here without our own tummy bumps? We live in a world inundated with sex. It's everywhere. TV, movies, advertisements, magazines, books, music, clothing, on and on. Is it any wonder that it causes so much trouble? A good, God-given thing with a good, God-given purpose has been so blown out of proportion that we are confused by it, and we have to live with the consequences of that confusion. Unwanted pregnancies are high on the list of those consequences. It is true that people have to take responsibility for their own actions, but sometimes society has to take responsibility too. We who are opposed to voluntary abortion have to open our hearts and minds to the reality of unwanted pregnancies and the women who suffer them. We need to channel our energy and emotions towards finding a remedy for this broken, difficult condition. I recently read a review of a book written by a Southern Black OBGYN physician named Dr. Willie Parker, who is both a devout Christian and an abortion provider. He claims to have been raised to believe that abortion is wrong, so he refused to perform them for several years after he began practicing medicine. However, he became increasingly moved by the plight of women who find themselves with an unwanted pregnancy. Gradually, after much reflection and study, he changed his mind about abortion being wrong, and now not only performs abortions, but believes he is practicing God's will and doing so. Perhaps we would disagree with him about his conclusions concerning the morality of abortion, but we must not disagree with him about the need for compassion for women in distress. A shared compassion for women in need must be the first step we take in our quest for common ground. We Christians know that Christ's love is always the first step. We can agree on that. It would seem as if we ought to agree about the need for education and counseling, but even that gets tricky. Many conservative groups are opposed to sex education in the schools. I've never been entirely sure why, but something about not wanting to put ideas into students' head. I'm pretty sure students already have ideas in their heads. The point is to get those ideas straightened out and headed in the right direction. Everyone agrees with the efficacy of counseling. The problem is that the two sides of the controversy are not counseling the same things. Pro-life people are advocating for no sex before marriage, whereas pro-choice people are assuming it. Pro-life people are denying abortion as an option. Pro-choice people probably are even advising it. Another area where it seems as if we should all agree is the need for birth control. What better answer for the problem of unwanted pregnancy is there than to avoid pregnancy in the first place? Yet many conservative Christians, especially conservative Catholics, are for religious reasons against using contraceptives. I can understand not wanting to use IUDs or the morning after pill because they in essence work by aborting a fertilized egg. But there are many other methods of contraception. Without taking the time for a theological discussion here, I find nothing in Scripture that forbids the use of contraception. It seems far better to avoid pregnancy in the first place rather than having to make a decision about an unwanted child. Perhaps the firmest ground we can all stand on is a shared commitment to fight poverty. The great majority of women seeking abortions live below the poverty level. Statistics show that when the unemployment rate goes down and the average income level goes up, the abortion rate goes down. This stands to reason. Women with a little money can afford contraception, and if they become pregnant accidentally, they are better able to care for a child. As it happens, we Christians have our marching orders when it comes to the fight on poverty. Jesus has made it crystal clear that we are to help the poor. It is such a serious obligation that he tells us our very salvation depends on how well we obey it. It turns out that in our efforts to help the poor, we are also alleviating the demand for abortion, a win-win situation. This leads me to my last point that I want to talk about. I've shared with you my opinion about abortion, that I can't make peace with taking the life of a fetus to end an unwanted pregnancy. However, I find another aspect of the right to life movement just as unsettling as abortion, and maybe more so, and that is the lack of concern for the rights of people after they're born. The attitude of so many anti-abortion advocates is, we have to get these dear little babies born End of story. No, it is not the end of the story. It is only the beginning. If you believe that birth is the end of the story, you should be called right-to-birthers or right-to-existencers. Life is about so much more than being born. It's about knowing God and living your fullest through Him. It's about kindness and justice and mercy. It's about loving and giving. Birth is necessary for living, of course, but it's not sufficient. We need to keep going and growing until we can't anymore. And we need help. Little babies can't do this on their own. They need someone to care for them and love them and grow them up and lead them to Christ. Every election year, we see signs sprouting up all over that proclaim, "We vote for life." We also get helpful flyers in the mail listing for us the candidates who are for life. No other issues are taken into consideration. As a result, Topeka is full of politicians who claim to love unborn babies possibly more than anything else in the whole world. It's certainly true that they must love them more than they love school children, or mentally challenged people, or people with disabilities, or mentally ill people, or the elderly. Ask Marcy why our Kansas school system is rated lowest in the country. Or Cindy about all the cuts that DSNWK has had to absorb. Or Billy about the choices her clients have to make. Consider the diminishing options for a mentally ill person who suddenly finds herself out on the street. Or think about the elderly man whose escalating prescription drug costs have left him with a decision between buying his medication or eating. Is this really a vote for life? Or in our concern for the unborn, are we being led down the garden path? We need to become really clear-eyed about what's going on in our country. I'm not talking politics here. I'm talking Christianity. We as Christians should be above the fray and taking the lead in finding the moral high ground. Instead, we are too often compromising our principles and fighting among ourselves. This is not an easy world we live in, but thank heaven we're only passing through. Yet we can't have blinders on as we go, ignoring our fellow travelers. We have to help each other, even carry each other if it becomes necessary. So let's try to do something about this nasty chasm in our country, dividing so many of us, even Christians. The controversy over abortion is a challenging place to start, since it's so highly charged and emotional for both sides of the divide. But we can find common ground if we try, and we must try. We can start with compassion. Everyone needs God's love. Unborn babies, born babies, mothers who want their babies and mothers who don't, fathers, siblings, grandparents. So many people are affected by the decision whether to abort or not. We can all work toward a world where there are no unwanted pregnancies. This is, of course, pretty unlikely to happen in our fallen world, but that shouldn't stop us from trying. The closer we get, the better off we will be. I know not everyone agrees with me, but I like to make one of those steps to getting closer, be making contraception easily available. Now that Planned Parenthood is gone, we have no free birth control in Hays. This, by the way, is part of a major problem that I perceive in our war against abortion. Right to Life supporters want to do away with Planned Parenthood and other women's clinics that provide free women's care because of their advocacy for abortion, both here and around the world. Yet almost no one replaces these clinics with anything providing the 90% of the services that are offered by Planned Parenthood that have nothing to do with abortion. It seems pretty self-defeating to preach no abortion, but then deny the health care and contraceptives necessary to make unwanted pregnancies not happen. Another step we can take and do agree upon is the need to stamp out poverty and work together to help people meet their basic needs. One out of every five children in this, the richest country on earth, goes to bed hungry. We don't need to be adding more children to that number. Instead, we must be feeding these children, helping their parents find work, and keeping all of them healthy. Christians' only choice here is not whether to help, but how. God is not interested in excuses or rationalizations. So, let's remember who we are and why we're here. Whether lifers or choicers or unsurers, we are first and foremost Christians. Our desire to serve Him is our common ground. We know that through Him, we can bridge any chasm with our love. We mustn't let ourselves forget it.
You've been listening to a message presented at Hayes Christian Church. Hayes Christian Church is a non-denominational fellowship in Hayes, Kansas. We are supported by the generosity of our members, attenders, and friends. The financial support we raise goes to projects which further spread the gospel to those who do not yet know Jesus, to local, national, and international missions, and they help to keep these podcasts free. If you'd like to share a monetary gift with us, please visit our webpage at hayeschristianchurch.org and click on the donate button. Or you may mail your gift to P.O. Box 1111, Hayes, Kansas 67601. If you have questions, comments, or would like more information, we would love to hear from you. Simply go to our webpage and click on the Contact Us form. Thank you for your generosity, and may God bless you as you seek to follow Him.